Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me again. Come let me love you, let me give my life to you, let me drown in your laughter, let me die in your beside you, let me always be with you. Come, let me love you. Come, love me again. Like the mountains in springtime, like the walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me again.
Well, over the years, we've featured a whole range of folk with respect to the field of romance, etc. But today we're looking at Annie's Song, an open-hearted memoir about a life spent loving the most vulnerable among us. Stories full of joy and life that keep loved ones close. She's one of the reviews that actually our current author is benefiting from, and indeed rightly, richly deserves, because we're actually delighted to welcome to Author of the Week, the fabulous Annie McDowell. How are you, Annie?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. Just share with us whereabouts in North America are we reaching you?
Oh my gosh, that's right. So you're across the pond. I forgot. I'm very excited. I'm not thinking straight. But I live in New York, in the United States, and actually out on Long Island. And when I was younger, I lived in Ireland when I was like 5 to 7, I think. And then I would go back a lot to visit over the summers. So it's this is my first interview for the book. So it's such a pleasure to be here for the first interview with you, Alex. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, already, Annie, I can hear our colleagues on New York Real Talk basically saying we must feature Annie on New York Real Talk as well. But that's another show for another time with our ace musical soul, Pamela Sue Mann. Now, let's talk a little bit about Annie's story, because obviously it's released in time for Mother's Day, obviously this side, so it's great from that point of view. But I see it's been described as a cross-genre, magical realism memoir, essays, poems, and music. First question, was it at all influenced by John Denver's classic Annie's Song?
Yes, it was without a doubt. And if you listen to his song after reading this book, which it's in here, you will understand more deeply the things that I wrote and why I wrote them. It's a very interesting book with the way the essays and the poems all meet one another with song. But yes, definitely John Denver's song was without a doubt a huge influence.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest, like a storm in a desert, and so on and so forth. I won't go through the whole lyric side of things there, but I mean, I felt it was too close a connection not to be influenced, but you never know. Even I said, I've never heard of John Denver's Annie song. I only thought he was good for Take Me Home Country Roads. That's another novel entirely.
That's right. That's true. But yeah, there's Annie's song. And you know, the beautiful part about it is, like, he's saying to me, all of my friends and close family members have filled up my senses, have gotten me through so many things, and I write about them, and even people I've lost that I've dearly loved, like my stepmother and best friend, they still help me get through, and they're not even here on earth anymore, but I have this belief that they're still with me.
Well, as we often like to say, we are such stuff as dreams are made of, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. I think it was Shakespeare who actually coined the phrase.
Oh, but, yes, yes.
all interconnected. Talking about your step into the field of obviously producing this, I mean, I think it's also wonderful that all proceeds of Annie's song are going to a range of fantastic causes. So was that a deliberate intention that you had in mind right from the start when you were looking to put together this whole message of Annie's song?
Yes. Yes. I knew I was going to have the donations for the dog rescue. One Love Dog Rescue out of New York here, because they do so much. And, you know, dog rescues work, especially One Love. And my teacher would always say, oh, this could be a book. And then the publisher said, oh, let's make this a book. And then I was like, well, I have to donate to the dogs. But then I realized two writing centers helped me learn how to write. And so they deserve something as well. And also the Stiff Person Syndrome Research Foundation is getting some of the some of it. So everybody's getting a piece of the pie, but me. But it's great because it feels like it's still coming to me, if that makes any sense.
Hey, listen, you've got to give to get back, and it's a wonderful sort of side of things there, and it's more than wonderful that you're actually doing it, and we're happy to endorse it. Let's talk a little bit more about the text itself, because I mean, Annie, one of those rare people who always looks for the rainbow in the storm's wake and uses her brokenness to help others by giving her heart to innumerable causes and being candid about what she's going through in the hope that her honesty will give solace to kindred spirits. I mean, it sounded initially when I read that bio as though, well, it's a 21st century Pollyanna. You know, it's somebody who effectively is always looking for the good classic things, and just as Pollyanna was. And what's not to love about Hayley Mills' classic Disney incarnation of Pollyanna?
Yes.
Was that something you kind of had in mind in terms of, we live in a world where there's so much negativity, or there appears to be? I mean, you just turn on the news and you get negative after story after negative story and so on a global sense, on a local sense and so on. So was part of your strategy for Annie's song to actually say, okay, let's look at those positives. Let's see how they can also develop this. I mean, we talk about trauma survivors, dog lovers, love seekers, stiff person syndrome, obviously from that point of view. I mean, this is the character, because Annie is literally in the end stages of stiff person syndrome. She's living each day, yes, and night, knowing that her next breath could be her last. Was that all part of the message you wanted to kind of address in this text?
Well, you know, I wanted to leave behind I don't have any children, so I wanted to leave behind some sort of legacy. And it was really important to me to write about humans being better with one another, kinder to one another, because you have no idea what, and it's always, we always hear, you don't know what anyone's going through. And like, so many people sit in judgment of others, how they're handling their illness, whether they're doing it right or wrong, or they should be over this trauma. And I'm trying to tell it, to explain that this person's still wonderful. This person's still great. They still have things to offer the world. And I'm going to offer things until my last breath as best I can. But I'm trying to remind people to be more empathetic and compassionate with one another in a lot of the essays. So, and it does have a lot to do with the way the world is treating one another, as you said, the way we are and the way we interact with each other. And I think when you have a better understanding of a disease, an illness, a trauma, you do change your voice in your head the next time you hear somebody complaining about their car accident that ruined their life. You say, oh yeah, that I understand that, because I remember reading that story and how it affected Annie's life for 30 years. So I do understand what my friend is going through.
There's a kind of echo, I think, in what you say, and I think a novel I once encountered by Mitch Albom called Five People You Meet in Heaven, basically, which again also addresses the notion of how every life touches each other in ways that we can't possibly know. I mean, it's almost as though what Frank Capra was saying in It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart is also manifested in this. Are those elements that kind of might have influenced your writing or your thoughts on the whole package?
I think you've nailed me. Have you researched me? Like, you've really nailed me, because the five people you meet in heaven, one of my teachers said, you live with a foot in heaven and a foot on earth. Mm. And that's how you're walking through life. Like, you're always, you know, especially now when there's the possibility that I could stop breathing at any minute. But, you do.
Well, hopefully not during this interview. I mean, let's face it, you know.
No, hopefully not during this.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
come on,
my nurse just left. I'm fine. Yeah. I'm fine. But you get a different train of thought when a doctor says to you, this is it, you know. And my best friend was killed when I was 15. And that's when my first trauma hit me, my first major one. Mm. And when she died, the only way I could get through was believing heaven was like right there, very close. It wasn't that far away. And that's how I got through it on my own. I mean, 15, it's hard to learn how to grieve at 15 on your own. And that's what I did. I put heaven right there. I know what it looks like in my mind, you know, like on here, Simon's my dog that passed away. And he loved running out the ocean when we went there once. So he's there waiting for me on the cover. So
you're a lifelong reader, and I think that's quite clear, an advocate for writers and books. You're an alumni of High Point University class of 1991, a sister of the Zeta Tau Alpha sorority. And of course, in 2006, you won a contest with Elle magazine to become a book reviewer for the magazine. I mean, you know, many people would say any one of those is just fantastic from that point of view. Was the novel always bubbling away in the background in terms of that? Was it a case of, when you were writing reviews and articles and so on, you felt actually that there was something that needed to be said?
100%. Before I was even sick, I knew I wanted to write. I started writing poetry. And in third grade, I started writing reviews at the elementary school. And ironically, the teacher's name was Mr. Book. And he's the one that said to me, "You, Annie, you need to read, you need to write reviews. You love getting people to read the books you read. So now you need to write reviews." So that's, you know, that's how it started. And it was kind of a joke with the L. I didn't think it was a possibility of winning because they were only picking 15 people. So I reviewed Pride and Prejudice. Mm. I mean, who would choose that? But I ended up being one of the 15 chosen, and I learned how to write reviews, and I've been doing it ever since.
It's not a bad novel to start with, to be honest.
I'm falling behind due to my army. I love that novel.
Yeah, again, I was going to say, if you're going to review one, you might as well go for one of the classics, which is great stuff.
exactly.
Let's talk a little bit. I mean, we talked about the Annie song. We know where that's come from. I think I know basically where the dreams and the dogs have actually merged. But dandelions. Why Annie song, dandelions, dreams and dogs? Is it just the ephemeral nature of life that you blow on a dandelion and suddenly it's all faded away and we wonder, well, where did that 4,000 months go, basically? Whoosh, it's gone.
Well, what's funny is I've always been in love with dandelions. I would always make a wish if I found a penny, you know, all those things. But the dandelion I absolutely loved. And in my stories, my last story, like I have myself on a dandelion seed. Not going to tell you what happens, but the dandelion seed is blown by a little three-year-old. Making a wish for her mom. And, you know, I used to, as a kid, I used, you know, you would go and you'd pick them when they're yellow. And then you go and you give your somebody like a bouquet of them. And I don't know, they've always been, and their nutritional value, you know, I make good tea. There's just so many reasons. And I found when I was going through my old essays and poems that are in here, I wrote about the dandelion all the time and Queen Anne's lace. And I was like, I like to write about weeds. So, yeah, that's how that started.
Yeah, the message you're actually there. And let's talk about your own influences. I mean, clearly, you're a voracious reader. The world of fiction has encompassed huge. I mean, you've got so many dice to choose from. I'm not going to necessarily say favorite authors. Well, actually, I am. Do you have any particular favorite classics that authors? I mean, are you a Bronte fan? Are you a Jane Austen fan? I quite like Mary Shelley because, after all, she got gothic horror to us, basically. What sort of things do authors have kind of inspired yourself?
Well, you know, I really, of course, I love Jane Austen. You know, I also, Louisa May Alcott. The first hardcover book I ever got was Little Women. And so right away I was reading classics. And then I loved to read the little yellow book that gives you hints of how the author wrote what they wrote. And I think that's how I got good at reading and writing the reviews. But I also really, I'm into new books that I believe are going to be classics. Like Robert Gwaltney's The Cicada Tree. I can't think.
I mean, I think
my favorite, sorry.
No, I was going to say possibly Yann Martell, The Life of Pi. That's
yes!
quite a classic one.
Yes. Oh, and The Mountain Sing by Nun Phan Quai Mai. That book is utterly breathtaking in its lyrical. I love books that are lyrical and have a beat to them. And that's where the music came in. Because when you're reading a book, there should still be like a tempo in your head. Because it keeps you going. And then you feel like the heartbeat of the protagonist or the writer, if it's a memoir. You know, so I'm really into, does it have a heartbeat? Like, sorry, my dog's making noise. Do you feel the heartbeat of the story? And in The Mountain Sing, I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's the first book out of Vietnam where a Vietnamese person wrote in Vietnamese.
We actually
Vietnam
did a feature
War.
With the author.
So did I.
A few years ago. So yes, yeah, we are familiar with it. Yeah.
Yes. And that's a wonderful. That's what I mean by a book that will become a classic.
Yeah. Interesting. You mentioned soundtracks. We've talked about John Denver. Some authors like to have lots of music. They get their Spotify lists out. They get various other things. They've got a complete set. They need to actually work through. Others prefer complete silence. Some actually like to have soundtracks only, no lyrics, because any lyrics can actually kind of percolate through the system. What's your own style of working, Annie? Do you prefer music, and if so, what kinds?
Yeah, I prefer music. At the end of every story or essay, there's a QR code, so it'll bring you to the singer's YouTube, and there's a Spotify like everyone has, right? And then I do like with lyrics, but there's some that I like without lyrics because You can read the story to Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, and it's like it fits perfectly. And it's really interesting. That was a very hard story to write, but it was about my friend's death, but it fit so perfectly to the song. So like I gave the song words, but it was the first thing that inspired me to write about my best friend's death, and that was this year in a grief class I go to on Sunday. But writing about it finally helped me get over a hump in my survivor's guilt, you know. And it's amazing how writing, journaling, writing poetry can change how you see something, how you visualize it. So I try to imagine her thinking good things. So I, you know, not good things the whole time, but anyway, it's all kinds of music. But like the 80s songs mean a whole lot to me, because that's when I really car accident. So like I have like what we were listening to on the radio, you know, Tim and I talked. And then I had a boyfriend Jay who was injured on the USS Roosevelt during Persian Gulf War. He got sucked into the intake of a plane and he survived. And I always say Jennifer saved him, but like the video, Jennifer is my best friend that passed away, but the video, like I put the video of his cool. You can hear my story, but then you can hear his side of the story, like his side of the story. Because I woke up in the middle of the night and I knew he had something was wrong. I knew he was hurt. So that song, Unchained Melody, that's like a huge, you know, song that the military people have taken on and love it, and it means a lot to them. And whenever I hear that song, I cry because I still think of him being injured. But he's well now, so things are good. But songs that bring you to the period of time that I wrote the song, or a song that will give you the feeling, so you will understand even better what I wrote about. And that's like the whole essence of the idea. I want people to experience the book, not just read it, because that's how I think they'll get a better understanding of what I'm trying to do. So I have suggestions at the beginning. Use this, put a scented candle with your favorite scent. Like I have all these little things to do. It might seem gimmicky, but to me, those are the things that help me when I'm stressed out. And so this book is good for people who know people that have trauma or illnesses, or people who have trauma or illnesses. I believe that's my hope anyway, that it will help. So.
In terms of what you've described, I'm mindful of the whole notion of transmedia storytelling, where you've actually got a full multi-sensory experiential line. You read the book, you have the scented candle, you actually listen to the music, you're tapping into numerous senses there, as well as, of course, the greatest sense organ of all, the mind and the brain. I'm intrigued by how you actually write physically in terms of. We live in an age where, obviously, as we're doing now, even though every so often the computer is saying you've got low bandwidth, it's okay. I think we're all right. We've got a couple of slight delays, but after all, we can work through that. But there are writers who still would say they actually need to physically hold the pen and actually make contact with the paper, and that helps them channel. There are others who effectively know it's the keyboard always. What's your own line?
Mine is the pen has to touch the paper, otherwise it's, my heart's not coming through. And that's in one of my, it's ironic, that's in one of my poems. And the editor or the formatter wrote that in script in the book. So I was like, oh my gosh, like she nailed it. Like I literally, like tears on the paper, you know. And I'm in love with Pat Conroy, the Irish author, and he always wrote with pen to paper. So that's what got me started with believing that was the better way to write. And then I kind of became addicted to it.
Interesting, because I know there are other people who actually say no, they couldn't do anything without a keyboard, and obviously the keyboard is a lot to be grateful for. And I'm talking about obviously a computer keyboard as opposed to a typewriter. I think typewriters possibly might have had their day, actually, but you know, they were good while they lasted, electric or otherwise.
If I had a typewriter, I do always ask my husband for a typewriter, but I never get one. But I mean, hopefully one day I will. But I do, I still have to get it on the computer though. So, you know, I still have to deal with the computer. And that feels like work to me, where the writing it is pure joy. And I wish I could just put the paper in the book, like my handwriting, but you know, you can't do that. So I'm always dealing with, and I always want some fancy fonts. You know, and that's because I'm in love with writing. And I learned they're not even teaching kids how to write script anymore. You know, so I don't know. I'm hoping that changes.
Well, you know, we can but hope that things will actually adjust. The book itself, will remind people, is, I mean, already an Amazon bestseller with respect to pre-orders and so on. Do you actually follow the socials? Are you are you TikTok oriented? Do you have any other sort of areas where it's a case of, for goodness sakes, you know, how could you actually get engrossed with respect to TikTok?
I can't hear
and
you.
So on?
I'm sorry. I missed what you just said.
I just really wanted to find out a bit about your thoughts on social media. Do you actually have an active Twitter presence, a TikTok account, or is it a case of no, enough already?
I stay to Facebook. I have some Instagram, and then TikTok is my dog's. You know, that's just for fun. But I stick with Facebook. Because I love the book clubs there. I love that we can all see one another, you know. But I cannot keep up with the TikTok book reviewers and the Bookstagrammers. They're a whole new level above me, technically. So I can't even go there if I wanted to. So
I don't think
I'm
you want to, Annie. No, it's a strange world. I mean, look at Elon Musk. Since he took over at Twitter, it's all gone pear-shaped. So, you know, just let it go. I guess that's the key thing.
No, I know. I don't understand. It's a big deal, like, when you can make a video, like, pointing to, oh, all of these books are blue, all of these books are white. And, like, that sells the books. I don't know how that's too much.
Too much data mining. Nevertheless, yeah. The book is out March 14th this year. Go and get it now. Obviously, it's available electronically. You can get it on paperback as well. It's called Annie Song, Dandelions, Dreams and Dogs. That's Annie Song, Dandelions, Dreams and Dogs, by, of course, Andy McDowell. Huge thanks from that point of view. We've got two things to actually ask you. We launched actually with John Denver and Annie Song. We'll conclude with Unchained Melody. But the two questions that we need to ask you, and hopefully we'll get through this, are, firstly, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Have you enjoyed this transatlantic link?
This is fabulous. It was easy. You know, I got right on. You are fabulous to speak with. I felt like you knew me very well, so it feels like a friendly, like a friend, like I just made a friend. And I really love that, because I interview authors. And I think you're better than me.
Oh,
so you're wonderful.
Well, the next critical question, Annie, is the killer, because obviously we talked about New York Real Talk. Will you be kind enough to return? Can we look forward to featuring you again in the near future? And will you come back to join us on one of our programs?
Absolutely, anytime. I would be glad to come back to do anything you'd like me to do. I would be more than happy to.
Fantastic. Well, up next, as I say, Unchained Melody, followed by features on quirky dating hobbies and how quirkadisiacs can actually help people in all sorts of relationships routines, plus some features on gardening as well. But for the moment, we salute you, Annie McDonald. Keep on keeping on, and we'll see you again very soon.
Thank you so much for having me, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks, everybody.
lonely time. And time goes by so slowly, and time can do so much. Are you still more? I need your love. I need your love. God, speed your love to me. Lonely rivers flow to the sea, to the open arms of the sea. Yeah. Lonely rivers sigh, wait for me. Wait for me, I'll be coming home. Wait for me.
Well, maybe the statement that was made in the 1990s is correct. Maybe the geeks shall inherit the Earth. Certainly, if we actually look at the top five quirkodisiacs for potential success in dating, we've got gaming at number five, listening to pop music at number four, gardening number three, playing board games at number two, and reading and collecting comic books right in at number one. Well, we need to obviously drill a little bit deeper into the findings of this particular survey, and we're delighted to welcome relationship expert extraordinaire Charlene Douglas to share with us the notion of why we should actually embrace our quirkiness. How are you, Charlene?
I'm very well, Alex. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for giving the platform for us to talk about something so amazing, quirky hobbies.
Well, that's right. I mean, I talked about geeks in the introduction, of course. I mean, that's one thing. But I mean, other than gardening, most of those top five were very much the things that probably would have been regarded as the the train spotting approach to life, etc. Or is that just too general?
Well, I think the biggest is this. So many people have like quirky hobbies that they don't always feel comfortable talking about. And Candy Crush Saga have coined this term quirkodisiac, which I absolutely love this term. And what we know is that actually a lot of people find it quite attractive to find out that you have a hobby that maybe no one else really has or not many people have. But it's all about how confident you are with that hobby and how confident you are speaking about it. And that's often the problem. People are not always so confident sort of owning their hobby, but there are a lot of people that find it attractive.
I mean, I noticed that Trainspotting isn't actually in the top five. Is that
No.
because it's fallen out completely, or is it a case of no? That'd be a step too far. We can cope with your gardening whilst playing board games and reading comic books, but if you're into Trainspotting, no, that's definite no-no.
I think Trainspotting is quite attractive, actually. I think it's quite different. It's, you know, it's something that you wouldn't normally expect maybe people of today's generation to say that they do. But I would, maybe the therapist in me would mean that I'd sort of dig deeper into, like, oh, really? How often do you do that? Or, like, what's so fascinating about it for you? And oftentimes when people are talking about a hobby that they really enjoy, you see their face light up. You see them, they're really passionate about it. They have a little twinkle in their eye. And that is always very attractive.
Yes, I suppose it all depends on the phrasing of the question, because if you actually phrase it, what is that about that hobby, basically, it may well be seen as a kind of passive-aggressive approach, really. It could be a nightmare out there, but what the heck. Let's look at your top five dating tips, Charlene, if we may, because this is quite an interesting side of things there. I mean, as you said, this whole notion of difference being exciting, a sense of mystery and so on, is that something which ultimately it's a case of people are intrigued by somebody who might be passionate about, I don't know, model railways, for instance?
There's a bit of a like dopamine effect, like that kind of, you know, the desire to want to know more that can be really attractive and can create like an intimate bond between people. You want to know a little bit more about your partner. And so a lot of the couples that I work with will say that years down the line of when they've been together forever, there's nothing new to find out because they kind of know everything. But at the early stages of a relationship, you want to learn about them. You want to know what makes them smile, what turns them on, what turns them off. Like, these are really important things. And I think the more you can be okay with your hobby, the better it is for you and for your date and for your relationship.
Is it often the case as well that people tend to associate in certain ways with people who are like-minded? So if you're both into a particular sport, for instance, or if you're into a particular Dungeons and Dragons multimedia role-playing game and so on, there is that connectivity to start off with. Is that also a way in which perhaps we do need to share from the off, really?
Yeah, I suppose there's a bit of both there, really, isn't there? Because there are times where you share something with someone where they also have the same interest and you're both just so excited that you're sort of talking over each other and, you know, you're talking about the levels that you've got to, for example, with Candy Crush Saga, that, you know, what level are you up to? And I'm up to this level. And how did you find that game? And that can be really exciting. But I think equally, even if someone doesn't have the same interest as you, if they are interested in you just in general, they will be intrigued and they'd want to find out a little bit more about your quirky hobby. But as I said, it's all about how you deliver that message. If you're shy and a bit nervous about it, you know, if you're like, oh, I do train spotting and I'm not really comfortable about it, but I don't know, is that okay? Like, that's not attractive. You've got to own it. You've got to speak it with confidence and your passion will show from that.
I'll just say, for the record, I've never done train spotting and I don't connect with that. So not that I have anything against train spotters, but I'm just saying. I do like the line where you said, if you're really nervous, then allow your date to learn other facts about you first. So effectively, maybe not go full on to, yes, I only collect EC horror comics from the pre-Frederick Wortham era of the 1950s. That's possibly too much information.
Yeah, so it's important that they see all of who you are. And I think it's always good to sort of start with like the things that are maybe not too quirky. So maybe, you know, some hobbies that maybe everyone kind of has, like, you know, maybe watching TV every now and again, maybe talking about your favorite TV program, talking about the things that you like in a partner, talk about kind of what your goals and your dreams are. And then as they sort of draw into that and they become maybe quite excited and feel quite connected to you, you might want to find that opportunity where you can say, actually, I do quite like a little bit of this or a little bit of that. And then just sort of test the water. But by that point, they know that that's not all of who you are, you know, but there's so much more to you as well. And it'll hopefully make them feel really intrigued and want to know more.
In an era of Spotify and streaming and selecting your own channels and so on, I was interested to see that listening to pop music is still pretty high, actually. I mean, is that opposed to listening to classical music, jazz, or other musical forms?
Well, look, I suppose whatever type of music you're into, I think the point with this is that it's okay to say that you have a genre of music that you really enjoy. And again, it's just how you speak about it. Now, you can talk about pop music and you can maybe talk about your favorite pop artist and the fact that you went to a really great concert and, you know, how it was so great to see this person. And then you can ask them questions. So, you know, like, are you into pop music or what type of music do you enjoy? You then need to make sure that you've got the same level of passion as they are talking about their, you know, their interest, you know, that you're asking questions, that you're interested in what they have to say. And you sort of, you know, and that's the way that you form a bond with someone, not just talking at them, but talking, you know, as part of a dialogue.
Yeah, I'm sent to suggest that actually the Eurovision experience of listening to music could well be a make or break part of a relationship, effectively. You know, it could go either way with respect to that. Yeah, absolutely. Where can people find out more details about these Quirkadisiacs and indeed the Candy Crush Saga survey as well?
So you can head to my Instagram, so Charlene Douglas Official. Let me know exactly what you want to know and then I can direct you. I can send you in the right direction.
Charlene Douglas, a relationship therapist and, of course, star of Married at First Sight. From your own perspective, actually, Charlene, was it a case of you started sharing hobby information on the first date?
I would say that sharing quirky hobbies is always an interesting thing to do. I wouldn't say it's something that I've necessarily done. I've probably waited a few more dates down the line, but I know for the Married at First Sight couples that some of them have shared some quirky dates and quirky hobbies, and it's worked really well for them.
Well, there you go. Charlene, many thanks indeed, and keep on keeping on.
Lovely. Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Gardening. Well, okay, with the weather being as it is, you might have thought, what? We can't do that now. Actually, it's probably never a better time to actually start getting to work with respect to gardening challenges. But recent research suggests that actually most of us are indeed interested in gardening. Over 3/4 of us, effectively, are interested in gardening. But we put up those self-sabotaging beliefs and barriers, etc. We haven't got the space, we say. We haven't actually tried anything. Okay, fine. Let's try and address this immediately. And who better to do this than TV garden extraordinaire? It's the fabulous David Dominey. How are you, David?
Very good, thanks. And you're right. The research that's been taking place by Mr. Fothergill's, the seed manufacturers, are saying that not only are younger gardeners engaging, starting at about 26 years old, but over half of them are saying they're doing it because it's positive to their mental health and, you know, it brightens up the home that we live in. And when we say growing, we're not even referring to growing your own in allotments or in grow your own areas in your own garden. It's simply the windowsill. People that have identified that windowsill growing is the opportunity to engage with gardening in the comfort of their own home, producing lots of good crops on the windowsill, things like herbs, leafy greens, microgreens like bean sprouts, you know, a whole host of things that can be grown inside the home and then pick fresh and used for cooking. And this day and age, with highest rate of inflation and availability and the positive mental effects of seeing the process of growing, it's not just the ingestion of the goodness of the plants that you're growing to eat, it's the mental benefits that it gives too. So incredibly positive.
Well, certainly that's coming across from your good self, David. 41% of us, of course, found their love of gardening before they turned 25. Does that mean that effectively, you know, gardening and getting that allotment or indeed window box, et cetera, is not necessarily for the chronologically gifted?
Well, I think in many cases that since lockdown, where most of us, you know, if you look at the World Health Organization saying that a phenomenal amount of our living time is indoors now. So it's in the car, it's in the office, it's going to sleep in the bedroom, it's in the lounge. You know, we spend a lot of time indoors. As a human species, we are hardwired into nature, not swiping screens, but actively engaging with nature. The scent of honeysuckle in the air, cut grass, woodland walks, the sound of birds, all of it doesn't involve swiping, just getting out there and being human. And by engaging with plants, which we did because there wasn't much else to do during lockdown, and people working from home offices now and the like, the interaction with plants becomes incredibly important. And as a human species, we can see more different variant shades of green than almost any other color. And that's why, you know, in the entertainment industry, we've got green rooms reducing anxiety and stress. So the process of growing at whatever age, is important. In fact, we've seen a massive surge even in houseplants. You mentioned the younger. It's the first opportunity that many young adolescents get in personalising their own rooms is by bringing in plants, and to see it grow and the connection with nature and the environmental consciousness and the evoked curiosity, all of it plays a part. But, you know, even as adults, we love to be kids, and seeing the first snowdrops that come up and the daffodils in the area, you know, they make us feel happy. And that's it with plants.
It's presumably the same sort of buzz you get when you grew your first cress and watercress plants from seedlings. You thought, success, something has actually come to life and creation is there. I had to admit the mild amusement when you said, David, about green rooms, because in the hundreds of theatres I've actually been in, green rooms and so on, I've never seen any actually that actually were green in coordination and colour. One or two of them had plants in it, but I think that's one of the great myths of the industry, unless you've been frequenting different green rooms.
Well, as part of the job, you do end up in a lot of green rooms, and some of them are incredibly garish in the colours. But let me just come back to the process. The greenery is correct. There has been a variety of studies done in universities. There was a recent one done over in Holland that seeing green makes us feel happy. Okay, so if you were to you go out on that woodland walk, we all know the feeling of SAD when it comes into autumn and winter. It's the lack of foliage. Seeing green calms us down and makes us feel happy. And our brains explode with loads of different chemicals. When we connect with nature, these little neurotransmitters in the brain that are closely associated with happiness, both dopamine and serotonin, looking at long-term goals and looking forward to things happening, like seeds growing, or the success of seeing them germinate, it unlocks an element of happiness in our minds. So this active engagement plays a significant part. And if people haven't grown before, by going to the website mr-fothergills.co.uk/windowsill, it's packed with advice and hints and tips how a basic windowsill, perhaps without a radiator immediately underneath, with the light coming through, pots with some peat-free compost, sowing the seeds, you can have a whole production unit where what used to be hosting ceramic poodles and, you know, pictures of Aunt Edna suddenly becomes a green paradise that you're picking and feeding your family with.
Well, again, it sounds a tremendously exciting prospect, and you've shared the details in terms of contacts. Got to ask the question, David, what got you interested in the whole world of horticulture and gardening in the first place?
Well, I think when I was growing up, we always played outside. You know, that was a thing. It was climbing trees. It was out and about. It was conkers. It was everything that connected with nature. And the thought of working in an office it didn't really appeal to me. But then, remember, I was in Cubs and I was in Scouts, and they did this thing called Bob a Job. Whether you remember that, where you had to go out and do some jobs like do shopping, clean a car, cut the lawn, and you got money in for the Scout funds. And when that finished, I went round all the neighbours that I'd been doing the jobs for, and they paid me to cut the lawn to look after. And I was earning more on a weekend than a friend doing a month carrying up that heavy newspaper sack delivering them. And I thought, that's the business I want to be in, outside, and something that there is good career prospects. And I've had 43 years as a professional horticulturist. It's a marvellous industry to get into.
Absolutely. And of course, Bob a Job, pre-decimalisation. People will be saying he'll be talking about half crowns next and farthings, but never mind. That's for another tale another time. David Dominey, gardening expert extraordinaire, huge thanks. And keep on inspiring us with your gardening narratives.
Lovely talking to you.
Well, it's coming up very shortly, of course. What is St. Patrick's Day? Yes. Mother's Day? Yes, of course. And how can we remember that? What is the cost of actually forgetting Mother's Day? Well, we've got two fabulous souls to address this particular topic. First of all, actress, podcaster extraordinaire, and indeed mother herself of comedian Jack Whitehall. It's the fabulous Hilary Whitehall. How are you, Hilary?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex. How are you?
Excellent, all good. And from One For All gift cards, that's with the number four, as opposed to the actual sort of F-O-U-R notion, it's the wonderful Lou Hickey. How are you, Lou?
I'm great, Alex. How are you doing?
Well, I think this is the first time we've actually seen each other. We've done lots of radio pieces, but here we are. You know,
we normally have chats. It's so nice. I feel like I should take out my hand.
Well, I know. In genuine 3D, astounding.
It is. I know.
Let's turn to Hillary to start off with, if we may. Have you ever been, has Jack ever forgotten your Mother's Day, Hillary? Was there ever a moment where effectively he did and you would not let him forget it?
Well, actually, they won't let me forget it because it had a very bad ending. But there was one particular Mothering Sunday where not just Jack, but my other two children, Molly and Barney, all forgot. I'm doing this. They were teenagers. They forgot Mothering Sunday. So I we had a fairly tense breakfast with me with a bit of a po face. And I thought, I'm just going to have to try and be the bigger person here and get on with this. But I know I'll go and have a bath, have a relax, have a soak, you know, come back down and start the day again. Went upstairs, turned the bath on, thought, no, I'm not the bigger person, actually. I'm furious. So I went back downstairs. I gave them a 10-minute rant about how selfish they were, how thoughtless they were. After all that I do for them, they couldn't get me anything. They couldn't even make me a homemade card. It was pathetic. I said, I can't believe that you've done this. And so I gave them both barrels for 10 minutes, came back out into the hallway. There was water pouring through the light fittings in the ceiling. I hadn't turned the bath off. So I then said to them, this is going to be a very expensive Mothering Sunday for you because you lot are contributing to the building costs of putting that ceiling right.
And yet, astonishingly, putting the bathroom ceiling right, or indeed the ceiling from which the bathroom flows water down, doesn't make the top 10 lists, Lou, of ways to make it up to your mum. We've got video calls, we've got taking her out for a spa day, breakfast in bed, shopping trip. You know, we missed something there clearly in terms of the
building works.
The building works, but isn't it crazy though? Like when you think about it, nearly half of us have said that we have forgotten Mother's Day. I am guilty of that myself, Alex. I have to admit, I have forgotten on a couple of occasions. But in my defence, I was living in Australia at the time, and they celebrate Mother's Day that little bit later on the year. But it is, you know, based on the One for All gift card research, it does become a little bit costly. If you do forget Mother's Day, 33% of people said that it would cost them on pricey gift cards. And one in four people said they'd actually spent up to £75 just to make it up to mum thereafter and just assuage their guilt. So, you know, it really does pay to remember the special occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, turning back to yourself, Hillary, I mean, that was a very memorable incident, which actually probably has a motion picture screenplay written all through it. Basically.
Yeah, I'll be covering it in our podcast. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, in terms of general advice, though, what would you suggest for forgetful children? I mean, we could say, what's the third? It's the third Sunday in Lent. You must know this. But they might think, well, what's Lent? Et cetera. Yeah. How do you actually address that particular challenge?
And the issue, of course, is that it is pegged to Easter, and Easter is pegged to the phases of the moon. So the date is different every year. So it's there to trip us up. But they're all tech savvy, these youngsters. Could they not put a notification in their phone and a reminder? I think that's a starting point. But actually, if you do take it to the wire, or if they take it to the wire, the great thing about One for All gift cards, of course, is that there's a digital version, and you can attach a video message to your mother and send the whole thing off digitally. So, you know, there is no excuse not actually celebrating this day.
I think we take that as read. Lou, from your own point of view, have you got any suggestions for gift ideas that you would actually say, yeah, that's quite nice? I mean, you know, we've had the digital notion there, but what about physicality, the whole notion of genuinely sort of saying, look, this is to show we appreciate the fact that you brought us into the world?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, like a token gift card would be lovely. But I think ultimately, mammies love us spending time with them. And I think, you know, to acknowledge as well your gratitude. I know it's something that we spoke about earlier on, and it is so important, you know, to be able to verbalise to either your mom or your stepmom or the mother figure in your life. It's one day of the year. You know, yes, they have their birthday, but it's one day of the year where you can kind of sit down with them and say, look, thank you so much for everything you do. You know, and in our busyness, sometimes we don't kind of have that time or make that time to say thank you to the people in our life. So I think it's just really important to do that.
Hillary, you've shared with us your experience from Jack's perspective. Did you ever have any times with your own mother where you might have actually forgotten something from a similar sort of point of view? Or was it a case of, no, I was perfect? What do you think?
And I certainly wasn't perfect, although I'm very big on lists. So I always have lists on the go. But my mother would never have let me forget it, because she sadly, she was her mother died when she was 2 and her father died when she was 8. She was an only child. She was orphaned quite early. So these recognitions were very important to her. So there was absolutely no way I would ever have forgotten it, because she was an amazing mother, particularly she had no example herself, because she was then adopted by a part of the family where there was a maiden aunt who, you know, did the best she could, but it wasn't a sort of classic mother figure, and was sent off to boarding school very early. So she learnt on the job. So, and I had great admiration for her. So I would never have forgotten it, because she had quite a tricky upbringing. So, but I know, going back to what Lou was saying about gratitude, gratitude is such a positive emotion. And of course, it's been proven scientifically that the feelings of gratitude change your brain chemically, so that it's very good for your mental health to have times when you just absolutely acknowledge gratitude, because it's good for you. And I think, great, let's have more days when we can express gratitude for people.
It increases the dopamine delivery. So yeah, those dopamine receptors work well, which I'm sure will be a challenge for One for All to actually have. Let's have a gift card to celebrate Dopamine Day.
Exactly. Leave it with me.
Although going out shopping and buying something that you really want.
That's exactly it, isn't it? Totally. Yeah. Pretty with a gift of choice like that is what, 55,000 stores you can spend in a nationwide. I think that's definitely dopamine hitting.
Well, that's exactly what I was talking about. And of course, for further information, you can go to the website, which is one w-o-w-n-e I should say, not w, zero o-n-e. Lord above, it's the three w's and then o-n-e, one. Yeah. Four as in the number 4, all.com. I presume that's correct, Lou.
It is indeed. It's oneforall.com. Or else you can pop into the local post office, most major supermarkets nationwide. But obviously you'll find it there on the website too.
Absolutely. As ever, Lou, we finish with those two final questions, which Hillary wouldn't have ever had before. So it's going to be first for her. But Lou, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the Midweek Drive today? Has it been good for you?
It has been. It's been fantastic. And it's always a pleasure to catch up with you. As you said, this is our first time to actually see each other. So it's so nice to finally put a face to the voice. Well, I look forward to the next time.
Fantastic stuff. And Hillary, has it been an okay Zoomer for yourself?
I mean, who doesn't love a good Zoomer? I'd love this. Thank you so much. And also, I love where you live. It's a very beautiful part of the country.
Well, I mean, this is it. I mean, people sort of suggest that Lincoln has got its own greenery, but of course, you know, we can hype it up even further from that point of view. Hillary Whitehall, actress, mother extraordinaire, and general all-around wonderful person, and podcaster, of course. Hillary, where can people find your podcasts?
Oh, yes, The Wittering Whitehalls. Anywhere you get your podcasts, and please email in, because it's predicated on us dealing with people's problems and anecdotes, anything like that. thewitteringwhitehalls@gmail.com. And send one in and we'll try and give you some advice.
Hillary Whitehall and Lou Hickey, huge thanks. And just ahead of the game, happy Mother's Day, both.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Alex. Always great to see you.